Greetings, everyone. This is Manuela Arciniegas, and you are listening to Out of the Margins. In this very special episode of Out of the Margins, we're joined by a diverse group of education justice organizers in New York State who were integral to removing police from Rochester, New York schools. Moderated by my colleagues and fellow sisters in the struggle, AFF Program Officer Nayoka Acevedo and Executive Director of the Communities for Just Schools Fund, Jamie Capel. The group will discuss the origins of the police-free schools movement in Rochester, which organizing tactics contributed to their fantastic win, and what is necessary to continue to push education justice forward for the long term. It's important to note that this podcast was recorded before the discovery of the killing of Daniel Prude at the hands of Rochester police and the subsequent uprisings and community demands that were made in response to the brutal disregard for Daniel's life. Rochester, like many Black and Brown communities, have been calling for the city to defund the police and reinvest in community-led resources and support. Removing police from schools is one step towards achieving this goal. As organizations in Rochester continue to call for defunding the police, we want to lift the demands of Free the People Rock, a community-led effort of which a number of people on this podcast are members of. The demands from the Free the People Rock are as follows. 1. Mental health professionals should respond to mental health calls, not the police. 2. Create a Department of Public Safety to house a crisis intervention team, mobile emergency response, pathways to peace, and other violence interruption and non-police, community-based safety programs. 3. Ban the use of chemical weapons by the Rochester Police Department. 4. Ban the use of spit hoods by the Rochester Police Department. Prohibit the degrading and dehumanizing use of spit hoods by Rochester Police. 5. Prohibit mourning bans from covering police badges. The practice of covering names and badge numbers with mourning bans authorizes officers to act with impunity. Rochester community, we see you and we stand with you in solidarity. Thank you and enjoy the podcast.
Hello, my name is Nayoka Acevedo, and I'm the program officer for the Andrews Family Fund. I'm so thrilled to be joined by our Education and New Shifting Justice co-conveners, Communities for Just School Funds, to host a conversation about the history of the police-free schools movement in Rochester, New York, the moments and work that led up to the incredible wins in 2020, and the future of school discipline. I'm joined today by Jamie Capel, who will share a bit about herself and her work with Communities for Just Schools Fund, her relationship to Rochester, and lay down the context for our time together today.
Thank you so much, Nayoka, and thank you to all of our guests who will be welcoming momentarily. I'm Jamie Capel, and it is truly an honor to be here talking about police-free schools with this amazing group of folks today. As a little bit of context, Communities for Just Schools Fund is a donor collaborative that resources grassroots organizers working for education justice. We're 10 years old this year. We were started in 2010 by people in philanthropy who understood that even though the tent of those fighting for education justice has grown larger, grassroots organizers remain the least organized and the most impactful. So the work of our 60 plus partners around the country, in Puerto Rico and in Canada, is pointing us all towards a North Star. And when it comes to safety and belonging in and around schools and in communities, the question in this moment is, if this nation will continue to ignore the brilliance of those leading the way or engage in the possibilities they are pointing us towards. It has been such an honor to collaborate with our sisters at the Andrews Family Fund to uplift our partners' work, to learn from it, and to contribute to helping to connect the dots between education justice and youth justice through education and new shifting justice. And as for me, I'm a mom, I'm a public school parent, and most importantly for me, for today's conversation, I grew up in Rochester, New York. So I have a lot of hometown pride that I bring into this conversation and gratitude to the folks we're speaking with today. So thank you to everybody for welcoming me home through this conversation. Today, we're gonna be digging into what is years of work and coalition building by organizers and others in New York, in Rochester, that led to the June decision to remove police from Rochester City Schools. I kind of like to think of the conversation we're about to have as digging deeper than the hashtags. And we have an incredible group of people here to help us do just that.
Hi, everyone. My name is Rosemary Rivera. I'm the co-executive director of Citizen Action of New York and the Public Policy and Education Fund. But honestly, what brings me into this work is because I have been directly impacted by the school to prison pipeline. And I am a mother and a grandmother, and I can easily see how that cycle can continue through the next generation. So that's what brings me in. That's what keeps me in. The other thing that keeps me in is the very people that I do this work with. Fortunately, Rochester has a community of active members and leadership that are incredibly committed to changing the way that things work and to seeking transformational change. So it's very exciting work. It absolutely is a story that needs to be told. It is both heartfelt, it is smart, it has a lot of pain and growth throughout the entire story and process, and it opens up possibilities everywhere.
Thank you, Rosemary. My name is Stevie Vargas. I'm the community organizer for Citizen Action of New York and Alliance for Quality Education. I would say what brought me to this work is my upbringing and my own lived experience. I'm a product of RCSD. I also went to suburban schools, so I very early on saw the drastic disparities between city school district and the suburban school district and how it negatively impacts Black and Brown students who attend city schools. But what keeps me in this work, I would say, is my sister, who is very much a product of the school to prison pipeline, and we're still feeling those effects today. She struggled with a lot of mental health issues. She was a very creative student, but she was labeled a bad egg, and she was continuously suspended, pushed out into the streets, where she found her own version of healing, which was through drugs. And she's been in and out of the prison system, and she didn't get the help that she needed. So she's the reason why I keep doing this work.
So I'm Ricardo Adams. I'm a parent of two kids in Rochester City School District, a seventh grader and a ninth grader. I've been impacted by everything that's connected to this work. I didn't graduate. I fell through the school system. I was a client of the school to prison pipeline. I'm a Black male. All of this. I've been homeless. So I'm directly impacted by a lot of stuff. What brought me to the work, I'm gonna be honest, it ain't just because of my desire to do the right thing. This work makes me feel good. So I get a good feeling out of it. I really do. So that's one of the things that's kept me in this work, because this work is like a marathon. It's no sprint. And the community supports me. They make me stay here. So I've also got elected to the school board by the community about 6 months ago, and doing what I can there.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tali Beckwith Cohen. I am going to be a senior at the School of the Arts, which is a public school in the Rochester City School District. And I got involved in this work pretty recently, actually, earlier this year, when our school district faced a massive mid-year layoffs and students started to organize. And because of some amazing friends of mine and peers of mine, I got involved in fighting for equitable school funding. And I've been sort of involved ever since. I am a member of the Teen Activist Project through the New York Civil Liberties Union. And I'm really glad to be here.
Hi, everyone. My name is Iman Abid. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I am the chapter director for the Genesee Valley region, which encompasses Rochester and the 8 surrounding counties for the American Civil Liberties Union of New York. What got me into this work? I went to a public school system, but in the suburbs. So I haven't necessarily been directly impacted by the issues that we're going to talk about today in regards to the city school district. But growing up, you know, through an impoverished family, I saw the importance of the opportunities I got through my education and kind of growing into this want to do advocacy work and political work, understood very, very early on back when I was in high school that education was just one of the best tools that we could be provided with in order to succeed and be able to kind of gain opportunity throughout our lives. And so as I kind of grew more witness to the injustices and inequities across the board in every single agency and institution that we see in our own communities, I knew that education was kind of at the root of all those issues. Whether or not we were given equitable education or if opportunities were kind of, you know, taken away from us, and how much it actually played a role in like the concept of policing, or it played a role in social services that we needed, or, you know, healthcare services necessary, and how that all kind of became interconnected. And so I kind of really delved deeply into the want to end the school to prison pipeline and continue doing this work to make sure that there were no barriers in the way to kind of give every child the fair and just education that they need. So that's why I do this work, and it keeps me here because the work, it doesn't end in a day, and this victory isn't the only victory alone. There's so much more to do. I'll pass it along to Ruth.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to be with you today through this podcast. And for me, as an urban educator and as a community social worker, it's a moral obligation to make sure that our children, our students, have every right and opportunity to grow up in a supportive environment and to get the best education possible. I grew up educated mostly through the New York City public schools, and I've experienced my own self a lot of racism, you know, segregation, and really a second class at best education. And then when I came to Rochester in my high school years and attended the high school in Rochester City School District, that pattern continued, specifically targeting Black and Brown children. So that has become my life work. I love our students in the City School District. We've done a lot of great things also as an administrator with the Rochester City School District, just did a lot to help transform our school culture and climate, really elevated student voice, formed an organization within the city school district, if you would say that, called ROC Restorative, where we've centered our work around education and racial equity through a restorative practice lens. And it has been very successful in the last 6 to 7 years. And just really dedicated to that work because of my own personal belief or my own personal experiences.
So I'm Jennifer Bannister. I'm with the Center for Teen Empowerment. We've been an early partner on the Community Task Force on School Climate. And I would say, when I think about when I was a teenager and what, you know, developmentally, the ways that I was acting out, the risks I was taking, the boundaries I was pushing, we actually used to make a game in our small town of running from the police. That was fun to us as white kids in the suburbs. And when I think about how much the stakes are so high for young people in the community where I live now in Rochester, the 6 weeks after I moved into my neighborhood, in the middle of the school day, two young men were walking down the street and were shot. One of them died just about six houses down from me. My neighbor, who was one of the people I'm really closest to now, but when I very first met her, she was talking about how her grandson was being suspended and just left out on the streets, and really appealing to district and the city councilors to do something about that practice. And this was in 2006. And we noticed that our neighborhood was calling the police on neighbors all the time, things that were going on. And so we started to reach out and just build relationships because we knew we didn't want the police around all the time in our neighborhood. And so those relationships have paid off and shown us what it can be when you don't have the disconnection from each other, what you can achieve together, how you can take care of each other. And so I know that that model is the same for our schools, even more so because we're talking about children. And so I guess all of those things bring me to this work.
So as you can see, we truly have all the right storytellers with us to help us really understand what it is, why it matters to demand police-free schools. Not just police out of schools, but the kind of school climate the kind of belonging that all students, that Black and Brown students deserve. And so with that, we're gonna jump into really unpacking that journey.
So this story in Rochester, New York really started in Buffalo, New York, an hour away. In Buffalo, New York, there was a young man by the name of Jawan Daniels, was caught walking the halls of his school, was told to leave the school, basically suspended, pushed out of the school for walking the halls, and was shot to death in front of the school. Of course, when tragedy strikes a community, the community kind of rises up, but it has not been the first time that tragedy like this has struck. It just happened that other conditions across the country had laid the opportunity out due to organizing. Occupy was, you know, really going strong, etc. And when Jawan Daniels, when this happened and the community seeing the efforts of movements like Occupy said, we've got to do something about this, came together and occupied the boards in Buffalo, New York in order to change their code of conduct, which is the document that is kind of like the blueprint on how people should interact with each other. Fast forward, I was leading that work in Rochester with some amazing organizers and an amazing community, and I was coming home to Rochester. Now, this is where what is personal can also become public, right? So here I am coming back to Rochester daily. I'm a grandmother of an amazing Black grandson, Puerto Rican. I've gone through the experience of only getting through to the sixth grade, being pushed out and directly into the criminal justice system, and learning through the popular education that you were talking about, that organizing and organizations provide, what oppression looks like and how is it that you really need to change those systems. So at this point, I'm looking at my grandson and going, yeah, I know he busy. He is what they call busy. So, and seeing the trajectory that he was already being pushed out of the schools on the bus. And so I called a group of organizers, just volunteers, like, let's just look at this. Not seeing that this work had been done in Buffalo, but that the conversation really hadn't taken root. Part of what I've learned in terms of organizing is we get into it in order to win things, to build infrastructure, but we need to change the narrative. And sometimes people aren't considering the narrative. They're just like, that's the way it is. That's the way it's always going to be. But no, when we think about changing the narrative, it's also about changing hearts and minds. And you've got communities who have really bought into hook, line, and sinker on law and order in communities across this country. Law and order, discipline, you know, which to them, discipline equates punishment. It does not have to be that way. Discipline can be a way in order to teach people. We teach people how to drive. We teach people how to read. But do we teach people how to behave? No, we punish them, rather than teaching them alternatives like restorative practices that Ruth Turner does, like all of those different types of relationship building. And so fast forward, if you think about this comprehensively and you take yourself out of the history, what you see is a young African-American man, young Black man in Buffalo gets shot to death in front of his school. And then you fast forward and you see George Floyd. And you see a man get murdered in front of the entire country. And to be honest with you, so it starts there. So it starts in tragedy, and the victory doesn't happen until another tragedy strikes with another Black man. And if we don't honor that, but if the work of this group of people and so many others that are not on this podcast, and an incredible amount of people whose work participated on this, had not been setting up the infrastructure, right?
we're trying to build things. If they had not set up the infrastructure, when the window of opportunity was open due to a horrific crisis and tragedy by George Floyd, then folks like Iman and Stevie and the young folks on here wouldn't have been able to fly through that window. So the steps are absolutely needed in order to get to the other side. So in terms of the history, I just wanna talk a little bit about that if you've given me an opportunity to. It was volunteers getting together, folks like Ricardo, who's now a board member, board member on the Board of Education, but who were parent voices within, who looked at anecdotal stories and then thought really critically, wow, do we have any real data to show this? Do we have, and what we found was a fortress in terms of keeping data within the districts with no transparency. And we had to fight, it took us almost 18 months just to get the proper data in order to create a report that got a lot of attention and started the process of getting us to have a partnership model with the district rather than a dominator model that we've been accustomed to for so long. I really need to shout out also another national organization called Advancement Project, who was there from the very beginning, who really helped us. And it was interesting, all of the different intersections and how life comes full circle. While I'm trying to work with the Advancement Project on one end, Jennifer Bannister and others are working with the district and they're thinking of the Advancement Project, and the timing was right. People wanted to have the conversations. The dialogue that was brought by CJSF, the Community Just Schools Fund, to Rochester was the first time a dialogue was had on whether or not there could be alternatives in a public way. I'm sure privately people had the conversations. In a public way, that conversation had not been had. And the immediate reaction from the police and from others, educators, including the superintendent, was like, no, we need to protect the police. Yet we pay for them constantly. We pay for them, which could actually go towards educating our children. What we realized throughout all of these reports, et cetera, is that we can do better and we deserve better in communities. We deserve those resources to our children. It is for the benefit of the child. I don't want to take up so much time. I'll let it go there. Thank you.
Woo, Rosemary, that was a word. The problem with podcasts is that you cannot see all the snapping and clapping and fists in the air that you're getting, or our audience can't, but that is what is happening, everyone, to bring you into the visual. We are grateful for your leadership in that word. So, as you can see, we truly have all the right storytellers with us to help us really understand what it is, why it matters, to demand police-free schools, not just police out of schools, but the kind of school climate, the kind of belonging that all students, that Black and Brown students deserve. And so with that, we're gonna jump into really unpacking that journey. And I would love to invite a few folks, Stevie and Iman, I'm gonna come to each of you, to kind of help us understand what your organizing journey for police-free schools has looked like.
Sure. Stevie will probably fill in a lot more because we both had separate journeys kind of going into this work. We actually met through this work, which has been such a blessing. But I guess this work really dates back to a number of, you know, representatives, whether they were elected or school, you know, they were people who were impacted, youth educators, long before Stevie and I kind of joined the movement, that really set the pavement for us and set the way for us. And so there were a number of school board members long before we had even started having conversations with the school district, the Rochester City School District, on what school without police could possibly look like. And so I really want to commend them for doing that research, taking the time to investigate, to pull the documents out, really start to figure out what does policing in school actually look like. Because when we're talking about police, we're not just talking sometimes about those patrol officers that are kind of, you know, surveilling the hallways, but we want to understand more of like what are what sorts of responsibilities do they have? What do their functions look like? You know, what sorts of agreements are kind of put into place? And so with all of that kind of having been done prior to us beginning the organizing work, and I think like there's no real start and end to the organizing. I think it had already begun by the time that we were kind of working on it. It really kind of just, again, kind of set us forward in the right direction. And so through that information, we were able to really leverage this idea that based on what we understand, that there was no real proof or data that was actually showing us that these police officers were actually doing anything to protect the students in schools. If anything, there were data, whether it was national or local, or if it was, you know, the civil rights data by the Department of Education, that was consistently showing us the racial disparities that existed across the board, whether it was from arrests that were being made in schools to the level of suspensions, to the way that just different children were being interacted with. And of course, there was a clear discrepancy in a school that is very, you know, over 95% economically disadvantaged and Black and brown, that students who were Black and brown were being, you know, challenged and held to this much different sort of environment and standard in school, that the interactions they were having with the police were so normalized that there was nothing that was being put to question. And so we kind of came in and started agitating. You know, we said, wait a minute, based on this, like, why are you consistently investing $1 million in this department that's actually proving to be completely ineffective? Through having these conversations with the youth and, you know, having been, you know, an outsider looking in, one of the things that I knew that I needed to do was make sure that I centered voices of those who were impacted by it. And so we developed the Student Ambassadors Program, the Teen Activist Project at the ACLU of New York, over a year ago now, to kind of just really give opportunity to students to really both ask them and engage them on a number of issues that were relative to them as far as like their educational opportunities went and what education looked like to them. And through those conversations, through that development of the program, we were able to say, okay, it looks like actually police officers in schools is a huge problem, that a lot of students of color weren't necessarily feeling safe, that very often students actually had no idea what the function of those officers actually were, you know? And there was also this very discombobulated idea that these officers were there to protect them, right? And I think having the opportunity to kind of sit down and show them just why we felt they were so ineffective and what they were actually proving to us, both in the data that we were able to kind of come up with and the data that was already given to us, you know, I think we were able to have those conversations in a way that really proved to them that this was an opportunity to actually remove those officers from schools and not just say we needed to remove them without finding an alternative, but rather, okay, wait a minute, where are we lacking in other sectors of the educational and, you know, on top of the budget issues that we're experiencing in the last year, I mean, many years, like not just last year, but many years, you know, why is it that we're constantly losing out on the positions that are most supportive to students, like counselors, social workers, and everyone else, and teachers, while consistently investing more in police when they're not actually proving to be effective?
Yeah, I'm going to plus one on everything that Aman said. And she said it way better than I ever could. When it comes to my journey organizing, it really starts even before citizen action, because we are all organizers in our life, right? So it really started with advocating for my sisters. They attended Charlotte High School, and it was constantly going to the school, speaking to the counselors, speaking to those in positions of power, and really questioning why things are. Why aren't they getting access to this? Why aren't they in this class? Why is the structure this way and not that way? But there was also privilege in that, because not all students have advocates in their family that can do that for them. And when people in the school saw that these students had people in their corner, they listened. And the students that didn't have people in their corner were pushed aside. And we saw that. And that really started my organizing journey and made me much more passionate about this work. And it also really highlighted how we ourselves have been conditioned to accept this form of policing in our schools. Because for generations, we have been told that we are dangerous. And when you continuously treat a person as being dangerous, we start to internalize that, we start to believe it, and then we start to perpetuate it and defend it. So when I became a community organizer with Citizen Action, I really got those tools on how to have these deep conversations with people. And it was always, why? Why do we accept these things? Why is it the way that it is? And it's constantly like going back to like a toddler. It's like, well, why? Well, why? But why? And it really makes us unpack that for ourselves. And that is how we have been able to get people to, I don't want to say agree, but like also advocate for police-free schools. And I have really been inspired as well by the efforts and the work of Leon. Citizen Action and NYCLU actually worked to bring them to Rochester, where we had a massive town hall and we organized together. And went the night of the town hall, actually, it was a huge snowstorm and people still came out. We had close to 200 people who came out in the middle of a snowstorm to hear this conversation about police-free schools. And it was predominantly Black and Brown students who came to that town hall, which was amazing because we want those who are directly impacted to come to these conversations. And when we talk about those who are directly impacted, but also the most ignored in these conversations, it's the students. It is always the students. And they will tell you firsthand what it's like being in a school that's over-policed. They don't want to be there. They skip school. They're not engaged. They do not feel safe. They're treated like criminals, which they are not. And they lose trust with those who are supposed to guide them and help them through this academic journey. So I have been deeply inspired by the work of Leon out in Toronto, and the ability or the privilege to hear them speak has really guided my journey as an organizer to continue this work, but on the ground, talking to parents, talking to students, and talking to teachers, because we even have teachers in the district who honestly think that we still need cops in school. And if you are a teacher teaching in a predominantly Black and Brown school and you fear your students, I don't want you teaching our students. I'm more scared of you. So it's been a continuous journey and we're constantly learning and constantly evolving and adapting new techniques to continue this conversation, because it's an ongoing conversation and does not just stop at getting cops out of school. Because while we are reimagining what school safety and school climate looks like, you have people in opposition who are reimagining what policing looks like. And we have to constantly be on guard to make sure that those are not implemented.
Thank you so much, Iman and Stevie. That was a powerful word. And, you know, Stevie, I feel like you kind of set the stage for this next question I'd love to ask Tali, because, you know, you said something, you said, we've been conditioned to accept policing in our schools, or right, fill in the blank there. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've been in with organizers where they talk about the journey of getting involved with an organizing group and realizing that, like, the shame and the guilt that they have been taught to hold in their bodies around, I must have done something wrong, which is like a mask for systemic failure. How connected that is to this next question, which is that there's this thing the world tends to do, specifically act like organizing to advance an agenda wasn't a part of the victory. And to be clear here for our audience, organizing is absolutely developing a clear set of demands for what you want and need, but it's also building a base, collectively engaging and learning, in other words, popular and political education, learning how to use the levers of democracy to address historic systemic failures. And that scares people, is what is clear. And so the burden continues to be borne by those closest to those failures. So Tali, I would love to kind of do a little bit of history textbook writing with you now. Let's make sure organizers' work is not boiled out of this victory. So if you were writing the local history of this victory, how would you connect this kind of police-free schools victory to local organizing efforts to build positive school climate end the school to prison pipeline or elevate youth justice? Would love to hear your history lesson.
Yeah, that's a interesting way to put that question. I like it. I think the first thing I'll say is absolutely what you said. When I first got involved in fighting for education equity earlier this year with the Teen Activist Project, you learn pretty quickly that it is hard, it is grueling work, and the victories are few and far between. So I think that's absolutely true, that like the amount of work that went into this one victory is massive. And I don't know if when this is written about, when it's talked about, when we look back on it, if all of that work will be remembered. And I certainly hope it will be. And I also certainly hope that students' contributions to that work will be remembered, because I think that is so important. I think that one of the really interesting and amazing things about, you know, this specific fight was that there was so much student involvement in it. It was coming from students. We were calling into board meetings. We were talking to our representatives. We were kind of working around the clock for it, going up sometimes against our own school administrators and our own teachers. So just remembering that how much of an impact the youth had on this issue, I think, is really important. And the next thing I'll say is, when you say like, where does police-free schools kind of fit into our bigger vision for what schools should look like? I would say that it is a first step. We've gotten police out of schools, but then we need to talk about what happens next. We've got police out of schools, and that's so wonderful for all the reasons everyone said, but we've got police out of schools, and now we have this resources that we used to be spending on police officers, and what do we do with those now? So I think this is just half of the history, and the next part of the history needs to be investing in social workers, in counselors, in reading teachers, in special ed teachers, in social emotional support systems for students. And I think that is what the next part of the history has to be. So we've got the first part, but in looking towards the future, our work is not done. We have to make sure that we fill the gap that police officers had, not in with more security or more discipline, but with social emotional support. So I hope that answered your question.
Absolutely. That was just a beautiful history lesson and grounding. And you know, you set the stage so perfectly for a little bit of digging into like what the power building looked like, right? There is tremendous sophisticated analysis that happens in good organizing praxis, especially when building coalitions towards a shared strategy or tactic. Jennifer, would love to kind of turn to you and then Ruth, just help us to understand what that inside organizing really looked like and how it led to the victory.
Yeah, and so I think that part of this is that conversation that's been had nationally, that as we're seeing, say, Confederate statues falling suddenly, policies like 50A being taken down in New York State, people might think like, oh, that just happened. Look at people came out in the streets. All these things start to happen, but there's a whole foundation of things that happen for years of organizing that people put in. And so there is a foundation to getting police out of our schools that probably even begins before this, but the work on school climate and the effort that Rosemary was referring to around breaking the school to prison pipeline and getting suspensions to be a last resort, all of the work that went into that was really an inside outside kind of approach, strategy. And so there was the outside work that we called ourselves Solutions Not Suspensions after, I believe, Buffalo started that. And that was teen empowerment youth organizers and parents from the Education Committee of Citizen Action of New York. And they would have strategy sessions, do power analyses and mapping. They would show up at school board meetings and do creative actions as well as speaking out to get the code of conduct changed and to move away from punitive approaches to discipline, to restorative community building, to move away from criminalizing youth toward caring and focusing on social emotional health. And the youth did a lot of spoken word at the school board meetings. The youth and the parents together would create these human chains to demonstrate kind of visually the criminalization of young people and students. And so through that work, that was the outside piece of it. And then the Community Task Force on School Climate came together, and it was interesting because Superintendent Bolhan Vargas was in that position at the time. And he knew that he was lacking the political capital to change the code of conduct. He probably had a fairly linear approach to it at the time and was looking to hire a consultant. And so Advancement Project was brought to his attention as a group that does this as their mission, that they've been working around the country. But the Advancement Project doesn't work with districts. They work with community organizers. And so he actually initiated that thought of, like, I need the community. And so he approached Teen Empowerment, as well as our local community foundation and Citizen Action. And we brought together a group of parents, students, mental health providers, juvenile justice focused folks, restorative nonviolence practices, and youth leadership development folks to work with the district. And there was a lot of trust building that had to happen. There was actually questions about whether we wanted the deputy superintendents at our table. And we worked really hard together and very honestly with administrators and folks from the different unions to come to a place where we could all really work together and trust that we were working in good faith. So that was a really important piece. And then just the other pieces that I hope that you could get from youth organizers directly at some point is the work that the youth organizers did around when there was pushback from the teachers union, for example. They were not feeling the code of conduct idea because they felt like it was an unfunded mandate where they would not have that tool at the hand. And meanwhile, they wouldn't have the resources available to them. And so the youth organizers held focus groups and met with teachers union folks. And we also had parents run parent focus groups, and the youth organizers met with over 400 students. We met with building staff. We just built all those relationships because ultimately, sort of like Tali was saying, you can't just pass a policy and think that we won. Because I think that that's often the approach of organizing. It's like we work so hard to get the policy or whatever it is changed, get the statue down. And ultimately, if we don't also look at the culture shift that has to happen, the relationships, the hearts and minds that have to be won over, we're not going to get very far with it. It will sit on a shelf, and that's that. So the youth organizers also trained all the principals, over 200 principals and administrators, in the guiding principles of the code of conduct that the principals had been pushing against and putting out misinformation about. And it was, it was very powerful to have that student leadership. And then the parents also played a role. So I know that Ricardo will speak. And maybe we want to go to Ruth, though, off of the administrator piece.
So, of course, you know, as a school administrator, as a central office administrator, it's really challenging to essentially go against the system you work for. And it was so refreshing and essential to have the community backing. So when things got really complicated, when we had to fight for funding, it was so essential to have the backing of our community partners, our parents, our students, fighting for those things that we know are essential in our human rights. The partnership was very fragile at first. You know, many people felt as if the community coming in and quote unquote telling the school district what they need to do was taking away some sort of their power or their rights to make decisions as employers of the school system. So there was a lot of work to be done around building trust, really understanding our why. You know, it was very clear the how, but really understanding the root cause. What is our why? Why are we engaged in this work? Why is it good for the community? Why is it good for students? Why is it good for teachers? Why is it good for administrators? So it took us a long time to really get that buy-in. So it was essentially, I was sort of working on the inside while the community task force was doing a lot of work organizing the community on the outside to really get the school system to understand why that change was so essential and also critical for the success of the school system. So it was quite challenging at many times to have to stand against the people you work with and you work for to say, you know, this is not right. This is not good for students. and that we really have to make a demand of the system to change. And we know that power concedes nothing without a demand. So it's quite challenging, but it was absolutely worth it as we begin to see the successes, as we begin to see the data that proves that this idea of community building and positive school climate is beneficial for the students, is beneficial for the school system. So it's definitely not a work for the faint of heart. And I think it's, you have to have that moral compass to say, I must engage in a work that I believe is right, that I believe is right for my community, regardless of what those consequences may be down the road.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Ruth. Ruth, can you share, before we jump into the next question, can you share a little bit about the restorative justice work, right? And how in the conversation to remove, please, that there were these tools that existed, and provide a little context to how those tools were introduced to the school, how folks were trained, and how restorative justice becomes an integral part of this, of solutions, right? And so when we think about police-free schools, it's not only about removing, but it's about also creating the solutions and the environments we want. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. And so how we began to engage our school district in the work around restorative practice and building those infrastructures for support and positive school climate was really begin doing the personal work of engaging every school administrator face-to-face to share with them our why this work was important, why this work was essential for student success, and really invited them. It was never a mandate. It was an invitation to take the journey with us to become a more restorative school district, a more restorative community. And we had overwhelming responses and really did our rollout in a cohort model, because we didn't want to rush and quote unquote train the whole system at once. It was a fairly large school system, about 27,000 students and so forth. So we trained schools through a 3-year period in a cohort model, doing a monthly professional learning circle in which we broke bread. We talked about strategies, practice, affective statements, multiple strategies for educators and administrators to learn to engage students in a more positive, restorative way, truly taking what Rosemary said, this idea of discipline being teaching and coming alongside young people, not only teaching them, but also learning from them and making sure we're elevating their agency and their voice, because they have solutions oftentimes that are far more creative than ours. So it was really a commitment from the system to say, we need to do things differently. And here is a model that is really based on human dignity and the concept of shared voice.
Ruth, we're going to come back to you. Those are some excellent points raised. And you know, the beautiful thing about the story of Rochester is that in this story, we are learning that the struggle is intergenerational. Right? This struggle is both about the inside and outside game. And so having folks in the district believing in change, having folks in the community, and that this work is really relational. And so it's been beautiful to see how in this podcast, how you all are bringing in the different perspectives of that story, you know. And Rosemary opened us up by sharing that, you know, this particular story is founded in tragedy. And even the victories is founded in tragedy, right? And so we begin with the loss of Jawan in 2006, and we're now in 2020, where the nation is forced to watch the murder of George Floyd. And so while the District of Rochester is committed to making these changes, and these changes are moving, and things are, you know, getting better, and their policies being put into place, there is something about this moment that is unique. And so I do want to ask Ricardo, in the wake of George Floyd's murder, you know, what was unique about the political will and organizing context of this uprising moment that made the police-free schools victory possible in Rochester?
Okay. I wish I could simplify it, but it's not that simple. It's a whole lot of organizing is the foundation of this whole thing. I wish it was just one incident that caused the change, but it was a whole lot of work that was put in. When I think back to when it began, it began like around with Rosemary, for me, Rosemary and Ruth. Rosemary I was a young parent, and Rosemary then was organizing around education, and they brought in the thing about the young brother from Buffalo, which was really tragic. Fast forward, what we knew we needed to have in order to organize, you always got to have somebody on the inside, or you just can't get in. Somebody got to let you in the side door or the back door. So we had Ruth in there. So we was talking about suspensions. And so in order to talk about suspensions, to make it settle in with parents who are very important in this whole equation, is you had to talk about suspensions represent zero tolerance. Nobody wants their kids in a zero tolerance climate. So the opposite of zero tolerance would be something like restorative. Don't allow for the narrative to be anything in between, or because that's what people will try to push it to. What's in between zero tolerance and restorative? Nothing is there, but they'll try to keep from getting to restorative. That's what they'll do. They always try to change the focus. And they say we're afraid to change, but in fact, we prayed for change. And so once we started talking about suspensions, we started implementing little things, trying to affect the climate in the school. We started doing surveys, talking about Jermon, the brother from Buffalo. And once you start doing that, once the implementation starts, data comes out of there. Plus, there was already data collected. And once, like I said, we had the inside person, we had Ruth Turner in there, who was able to help us get some of this data. It can't seem to be some top secret stuff. Once the data is produced, then the kids no longer think this is how it's supposed to be. And they start organizing. They were amazing. They're the most impacted. They even brought their parents out with them. And so it just changed the whole dynamics of everything. And this was a community that just had passed the Police Accountability Board. So the majority of the community was not feeling a lot of stuff with the police. As far as their accountability was concerned, they were taking a lot of money out of the district to pay for these police salaries, $1.5 million for 12 officers, way too much. But we're cutting counselors, teachers' aides, and everything. So all that put together from I'm talking about years of work we had to put in, years of collecting data, arguing. Ruth Turner must have almost lost her job 3 or 4 times in the process. Not nothing new in the process. I remember 3 or 4 years ago, we had to get up and everybody had to advocate to try to keep her from being pushed out. This is what the system does. The system will do anything to uphold the system. The system works well when it's power over instead of power with. The dominator model as opposed to the partnership model. I think it... In May, with George Floyd, I think it was enough, and the students were still on board. That was the most amazing part. The students had been activated back in December, really activated, and they hadn't given up. They had continued a campaign every month. They went to Albany, which is our capital, talked to senators, assemblymen. It was a constant campaign by them. And so they kind of demanded people listen when they talk. So we were on edge, ready for to do something different. And then came COVID. Then when COVID came, the students was like at home too much. They had a whole lot of energy built up. They were like waiting for an opportunity to step up. And that's what they did. They stepped up. And they're still stepping up today. I have to really give all the credit that I know goes to the organizing and to the students, man. The students in this community have really, really been representing. Ruth has done a lot of work with the students. She's built trust with them. And that's just important because the students don't trust real easily. I'm telling you, it's hard for them to trust you. And so they've stepped up and they've made the difference. I would say other districts, they got to have patience. They got to control the narrative because we've had people come with these kumbaya stories of the police doing this and doing that in the schools, and it's just as untrue. I volunteered in school for like 8 or 9 years in a row, so I seen up close. There was very little involvement of the SROs, except for when it's time to take somebody to jail.
Thank you for listening to Out of the Margins. We'll continue this rich conversation around the Police Free Schools movement in Rochester, New York in an upcoming episode. Yeah. All humanity, they fire at